From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Russia shows its modern military in Ukraine crisis. UN humanitarian chief urging the Security Council to act on Syria. Conflicts in the CAR and South Sudan on the Carry Africa agenda, plus WHO on upsurge in MERS virus. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukraine's interim president says his government is helpless to quell a growing pro-Russian separatist movement in two eastern regions, and he says the situation has deteriorated to the point Kiev cannot control its own troops. Alexander Turchynov's admission came Wednesday at a meeting with regional governors in Kiev. He said, I would like to talk again about the real danger of a continental war to be unleashed against Ukraine by the Russian Federation. He went on to say our armed forces have been put on high alert. Turchynov singled out mounting difficulties in eastern Ukraine, where he said some military units are cooperating with terrorist organizations. Separatists now control about a dozen cities in Ukraine's industrial east, including Donetsk, where rebels have set a referendum for secession on May 11th. A similar vote last month led to Russia's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula. An estimated 40,000 Russian troops are deployed on the Ukrainian border, that is, poised to invade if the order comes from Moscow. VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshna looking now at the makeup of the Russian military.
Western estimates say the Russian Defense Ministry controls between 800,000 and 1 million men under arms. These include strategic rocket forces, as well as the various services, air defense, ground, and naval. And there are various kinds of special forces, such as the Spetsnaz belonging to Russia's military intelligence, or GRU. Stephen Blank, an expert on the Russian military at the American Foreign Policy Council, says there are also paramilitary forces.
The other forces belong to other ministries. The Ministry of Interior, which are the internal forces of the MVD. The FSB has forces, that's the intelligence. There are border troops. And then there are paramilitaries like various Cossack formations. So there are lots of people involved here, probably something like a million men total in the regular armed forces, several hundred thousand more in these auxiliaries of the MVD, FSB, and Cossacks, and so on.
Ian Brzezinski from the Atlantic Council says the Russian government is spending a lot of money to modernize its armed forces.
$750 billion between now and end of the next decade to, you know, replenish their maritime fleet, to replenish their air forces, to bring in fifth-generation aircraft, even more sophisticated air and missile defense systems. They continue to robustly test and develop new ballistic missile capabilities, and they continue their modernization of their ground forces.
Brzezinski and others say Russia's effort to modernize its military was prompted by the poor showing in Moscow's 2008 five-day war with Georgia over two separatist regions.
You may recall the pictures of drunk soldiers straggling in the rear, trying to catch up to the frontline troops, and the fact that the Russians had a little bit of difficulty taking on the Georgians, which didn't put on that strong a defense, and they were able to kind of press forward simply pure mass rather than skill.
Experts say one reform was to make the Russian military more mobile, better geared for rapid response and for local conflicts, rather than with the massive Soviet-style army. Kerr Giles, head of the Conflict Studies Research Center, says during the Georgian War, coordination between the different armed service branches was a problem for the Russians.
They didn't, for example, have the right kind of embedded forward air controllers with their ground units in order to actually communicate with air power. So some of the air losses in the Georgia War were actually shot down by their own side, by the Russians.
Ian Brzezinski says the results of the reform were on display during Russia's annexation last month of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula.
You see the way they've been performing in Crimea, where you had 20,000 to 30,000 Russian troops fan across that peninsula. Pretty slick uniforms, well-maintained equipment, and real stunningly or impressive discipline and communications discipline. They're certainly far more capable than they were 6 years ago.
Stephen Blank from the American Foreign Policy Council puts it this way.
What the improvement is the use of these forces in a extraordinarily disciplined, bloodless, swift way in conjunction with information warfare against Ukraine, saturation of the Crimea and eastern Ukraine with Russian propaganda, and the deployment of highly trained, modernized, combined forces on the Western strategic direction to intimidate, divert, and immobilize NATO and the Ukrainian armed forces.
Blank says members of the Russian military leadership believe that the end of the Cold War was an American special operation to take down the Soviet Union without firing a shot. And it succeeded. Blank says the Russian military tried to do the same with success in Crimea. Andrei Dineshner, VOA News, Washington.
A recent survey found that Ukrainians have little faith in the interim government that replaced ousted President Viktor Yanukovych, with a majority of respondents telling pollsters it has little control over events buffeting the country. Jamie Detmer has more from Kiev.
It probably isn't what the U.S. government wanted to hear from an opinion poll it funded. Still, a survey conducted for the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, or IFES, a Washington-based international non-profit organization that assists elections in new and emerging democracies, found that Ukrainians think their country's in the grip of chaos and don't believe the interim government is effective. The poll, which was conducted in mid-April, found that there are widespread doubts about the legitimacy and effectiveness of the government of Acting Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
International Monetary Fund has approved a two-year, $17 billion aid program for Ukraine as the Kiev government struggles to maintain political stability in the eastern part of the country near the Russian border. Loan package also paves the way for Ukraine to receive an additional $15 billion pledged by the World Bank, the European Union, Japan, Canada, and the U.S. Ukraine, under pressure from international creditors, is expected to use part of the initial disbursements to pay down a $2.2 billion debt owed Moscow for natural gas purchases. Russia has, in the past, threatened to cut off fuel supplies, and as relations have deteriorated in recent months, raised the price of gas to its neighbor by about 80%.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Ballot counting began immediately at polling stations across Iraq after voting ended on Wednesday. Electoral offices say more than 50% of the registered voters turned out, despite a series of Election Day attacks that left at least 12 dead. Edward Uranian has more from the VOA Middle East Bureau.
Observers from the Arab League and the European Union were present in most polling stations, along with observers from local non-governmental organizations. It was the first parliamentary election in Iraq since 2010 and the first since U.S. troops withdrew in December 2011. Despite sectarian violence and tensions between Iraq's Sunni and Shiite communities, voting took place normally in most parts of the country, except predominantly Sunni Anbar province, parts of which are under control of Sunni insurgents. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
UN Humanitarian's Chief Valerie Amos said Wednesday that the Security Council resolution intended to improve humanitarian access to the millions of people in Syria is not working, and the Council must do more. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports now the council met just hours after a school in an opposition-controlled area of Aleppo was reportedly bombed, killing nearly a dozen children.
After briefing the council for 2 hours in a closed session, Amos told reporters that in the 2 months since the council unanimously adopted Resolution 2139, the hoped-for changes on the ground have not come.
Far from getting better, the situation is getting worse. Violence has intensified over the past month, taking a horrific toll on ordinary Syrians.
She said public pressure and private diplomacy have yielded very little progress, and it is now up to the council to act to get aid to the more than 9 million people inside Syria who desperately need it, especially those under siege and in hard-to-reach areas. While the UN and its agencies have succeeded in getting limited aid to millions of Syrians, Amos said it is not enough. While she did not say if she explicitly asked the council to adopt a resolution under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which would allow the council to take stronger action to implement its demands, she said she reminded them that in Bosnia and Somalia, it took several Chapter 7 resolutions to ultimately get the access humanitarians needed. French Ambassador Gerard Araud was not optimistic that the 15-nation council would be able to act in a unified way to take further measures.
My personal feeling is, unfortunately, after what I have heard, nothing that we could table to the council could pass. You know, really, we have the impression of an unconditional defense of the regime.
Russia, which along with China has used its veto on three occasions to protect the Assad regime, would be likely to block any tough council action. In Resolution 2139, the Council unanimously demanded the parties facilitate the quick and safe delivery of aid, including across conflict and border lines. The Syrian Opposition Coalition representative in New York, Najib Ghadban, urged the UN to move ahead with cross-border access, with or without Syrian government consent, to save lives. A report from the Secretary General issued last week paints a grim picture, saying 2 months after Resolution 2139, none of the parties to the conflict have adhered to the demands of the Council. Ban Ki-moon warned that denying food and life-saving medical supplies is arbitrary and unjustified and a clear violation of international humanitarian law. Western powers have urged Syria's referral to the International Criminal Court at The Hague. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry beginning a visit to Africa for talks aimed at halting violence in the Central African Republic as well as South Sudan. Secretary's first stop is Addis Ababa, where he will meet with the foreign ministers of Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya to discuss the South Sudan conflict. On Tuesday, a senior State Department official said Mr. Kerry will deliver tough messages to both the South Sudanese government and the rebels. The United States has threatened travel and financial sanctions on those responsible for violence that has displaced more than a million people. Meantime, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has urged South Sudanese President Salva Kiir to call for an end to what Mr. Ban calls a negative campaign against UN peacekeepers and bring to justice those responsible for attacks on civilians and UN staff. In a telephone call, the UN chief urged President Kiir to halt the vicious fighting, as he put it, and appalling killing of South Sudanese civilians. UN aid chief in South Sudan, Toby Lanzer, has called for a month-long truce, warning 7 million people face hunger if the four-month conflict continues. Two UN officials are holding talks with South Sudanese leaders in the conflict. Human rights official Navi Pillay and Adama Ding, the UN Special Advisor on Prevention of Genocide, have met with Riek Machar, the former vice president who leads rebel forces.
We had a good meeting of about 35 minutes and gave him the concerns of the Secretary General about protection of civilians. And we received assurances from him that he himself is investigating the human rights violations that occurred in Bientu, and that he is also concerned about protection of civilians here. He finds it difficult to be in the situation where he is, but I welcome the fact that he is clearly thinking in terms of a political solution.
United Nations has accused rebels of hunting down hundreds of people in a hospital, church, and mosque in Bentiu on April 15th and killing them based on their ethnicity and nationality. Sudanese and Libyan soldiers have rescued more than 300 migrants abandoned by human smugglers in the desert near their shared border. A Sudanese military spokesman says at least 9 of the migrants were dead and the survivors were hungry and thirsty. He said many were in critical condition and brought to nearby towns for treatment. Sudanese migrants trying to flee war and other miseries often use the desert border crossing with Libya, trying to reach the Mediterranean and Europe. Researchers from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine say children born to mothers who get pregnant during times of hunger could be more susceptible to long-term health problems. Jennifer Lazuta reports the research done in Southwest African nation of Gambia.
In a study published Tuesday in the online science journal Nature Communications, researchers found the children of women who conceived during Gambia's lean season had different genetic markers on their DNA compared to the children of women who conceived during the harvest season. MRC International Nutrition Group Director in Gambia, Andrew Prentice, one of the authors of the study, explained.
I think everybody understands that we inherit our genes from our parents and that those are the main ways in which we resemble our parents and we inherit the characteristics that they had. What fewer people know is that those genes can actually be altered, and they can be altered by several processes which are very complicated and not yet fully understood. But one of these involves adding little markers onto the genes which can switch some genes on or turn them off.
Prentice and his colleagues studied how diet affects which genes are turned on or off by comparing two groups of women in rural Gambia, one that conceived during dry season when food is lacking in both quantity and quality, and one that conceived during the rainy season when mothers have access to more protein and high-energy meals. The researchers followed more than 2,000 women across 34 villages between July 2009 and July 2011. Each time a woman gave birth, the researchers measured the markers on the baby's genes.
To our great surprise, what we found was very strong effects in the different levels of marking according to whether babies had been conceived in the dry season or the rainy season. And so what this tells us is that a mother's diet in preparation for pregnancy, or right at the moment of conception, is highly crucial to how these genes are marked, and that this almost inevitably will have large effects on their baby's health.
Researchers do not know precisely what the affected genes are responsible for, but are believed to determine susceptibility to cancer later in life, as well as weight gain and obesity, and the probability of dying from infectious diseases as a young adult. In addition to folic acid, which has already been shown to help the development of babies, the study concluded vitamin B and a chemical compound known as choline, which is found in eggs and certain animal products, are necessary to achieving the good markings on the genes and improving the long-term health of a child. The researchers say they hope to design interventions in which mothers-to-be are prescribed nutrients through diet or supplements. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
World Health Organization says it believes the recent spike in cases of Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS coronavirus, is probably due to a seasonal increase of the disease rather than to any changes in the behavior of the virus. Lisa Schlein reporting now from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says there is nothing unusual about the recent spike in cases of MERS coronavirus. It says similar upsurges have occurred around the same time in the past 2 years. WHO spokesman Gregory Hartl says the increase in cases is most likely due to the warmer weather in the Arabian Peninsula and to outbreaks of the disease in two or three hospitals in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. He says health officials do not know how the virus is transmitted from person to person, but it is clear, he says, the disease does not spread with the same ease that severe acute respiratory syndrome or SARS did.
We don't think it does transmit very efficiently, and it's certainly not anything like SARS or like diseases like influenza. There's no way we can predict the future. But for us at the moment, certainly this virus, MERS, does not have the ability to infect in the same way that SARS did. So that is a good sign.
Hartl says SARS is highly contagious. The disease broke out in China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan in the early 2000s. Over a six-month period at the height of the epidemic, nearly 8,100 cases and 774 deaths were reported. By comparison, Hartl notes, WHO has confirmed 261 cases of MERS coronavirus in 2 years. But the downside is that 93 people have died, which is a much higher fatality rate than that of SARS. The MERS coronavirus is shrouded in mystery. Health officials know that camels are one of the hosts of the virus, but they believe the disease may also stem from other sources. They also do not know why some humans get infected and others do not. The virus made its first appearance in Egypt last week. Cases also have been confirmed in Greece, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Indonesia. But WHO spokesman Hartl says patients in those countries acquired the disease while they were in Saudi Arabia. He says the virus remains largely contained in the Middle East. He says the virus has not changed its character. 30 viruses have been tested, he says, and none have mutated.
These viruses don't transmit from human to human because when they transmit from human to human, small changes in the genome of the virus will occur. However, in this case, we believe that this means that almost all the introductions still are coming from the environment somehow.
Hartl says health officials are faced with the big challenge of trying to figure out how the virus passes from its natural host or reservoir to humans. The World Health Organization says in the absence of any drugs to treat the disease, the best way people can protect themselves from falling ill is to practice good general hygiene. WHO says people should wash their hands frequently and keep their distance from people who show signs of MERS. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics, or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
British actor Bob Hoskins, whose varied career ranged from an award-winning role in the film Mona Lisa early in his career to the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, has died. He was 71. On the set of Roger Rabbit, which included animated characters as well as real-life characters, such as the part Hoskins played, he said it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do that kind of acting.
Because it's cinema history. It's never been done before. Not like this.
21 years after filming Roger Rabbit, Hoskins played a character in the animated film A Christmas Carol.
It's incredibly releasing. Once you get used to the fact that there's no camera, there's nothing to perform to except yourself and you fellow artists. And it's just wonderful. You just do it once. There's no angles. There's no camera. It's great.
Yes, indeed. Christmas Carol was out in 2009. That was the movie that starred, Jim Carrey. Yeah, it was a fun movie. A versatile character actor capable of playing menace as poignancy. He also had that Cockney charm. Hoskins appeared in some of the most acclaimed British films of the past few decades, including a gangster classic, The Long Good Friday. In 2012, Hoskins announced that he had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, that is, and was retiring from acting. He died of complications from pneumonia. Al Feldstein, whose 28 years at the helm of Mad Magazine transformed the satirical publication into a pop culture institution, also has died. He was 88. Building on a character used by Mad founding editor Harvey Kurtzman, Feldstein turned to the freckle-faced Alfred E. Newman, whose image always appeared on the magazine's cover, into an underground hero, a dim-witted everyman with a gap-toothed smile and the recurring stock phrase, "What, me worry?" Oh, well. Newman's character was used to skewer just about everyone from Santa Claus to Darth Vader, including the former U.S. President George W. Bush. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to The Voice of America today. Good to have you with us on International Edition. You can also find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair Eltaya, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. May 1st is often called May Day. Traditionally, May Day was celebrated by ancient Europeans as the time to make their first spring plantings. May Day later became an observance sparked by the labor movement to recognize the achievements of the working class. On this day in 1898, only days after war had been declared between Spain and the United States, U.S. Commodore George Dewey achieved a naval victory over the Spanish in the waters of Manila Bay in the Philippines. On this day in 1960, an American U-2 spy plane piloted by Francis Gary Powers was shot down over the Soviet Union. Powers was captured, tried, and sentenced to 10 years in prison. In 1962, he was exchanged for a captured Soviet spy. In 2011, U.S. President Barack Obama announced that terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, the mastermind of the September 11th attacks on the U.S., had been killed by United States Special Forces in Pakistan. On this day in 1786, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's masterpiece, The Marriage of Figaro, premiered at Court Theater in Vienna. The Marriage of Figaro is today one of the most performed operas in the world. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States, along with its G7 partners, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the EU, is deeply concerned over the continued efforts by separatists backed by Russia to destabilize eastern Ukraine. Ukraine has taken steps to meet its commitments under the April 17th Geneva Accord. These actions include working towards constitutional reform and decentralization, proposing an amnesty law for those who will peacefully leave the buildings they have seized in eastern Ukraine, and supporting the work of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. In addition, Ukraine has acted with restraint in dealing with the armed bands illegally occupying government buildings and forming illegal checkpoints. In contrast, Russia has taken no concrete actions in support of the Geneva Accord. It has not condemned the acts of pro-separatists seeking to destabilize Ukraine, nor called on armed militants to leave peacefully the government buildings they've occupied and put down their arms. Instead, Russia has continued to escalate tensions with ongoing threatening military maneuvers on Ukraine's border. The United States and its G7 partners strongly condemn Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea and Sevastopol. The G7 is now following through on consequences for this illegal annexation, including economic, trade, and financial areas. The United States announced it is imposing sanctions on 7 Russian government officials, including 2 members of President Vladimir Putin's inner circle, who will be subject to an asset freeze and a U.S. visa ban, and 17 companies linked to Putin's inner circle, which will be subject to an asset freeze. In addition, the Department of Commerce will deny or revoke some licenses granted to Russian companies seeking to export high-technology defense equipment. The international community has been unified in its position that Russia must cease its provocative actions in Ukraine. The United States remains prepared to impose still greater costs on Russia if the Russian leadership continues its provocative actions in Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.